bringing charm to the Iranian capital with some of the most beautiful Persian orchestra pieces and musical performances to jam-packed concert halls in Tehran. The most prestigious musical event in Iran is underway. The 38th Fajr International Music Festival opened in Tehran on February the 17th. While the capital is hosting over 30 music bands from across the country, foreign musicians have also found the opportunity to go on stage, including these Hungarian musicians. 7 concert halls in Tehran, as well as over 30 other arenas in 14 provinces, are hosting this year's event.
I am grateful to the musicians that took part in the festival this year. I would also like to take the opportunity to tell you that we have added some awards to our list, and other than the Barbat Prize for the Best Music Album, as of this year, we will also have the Best Song, Lyrics and Media Awards.
Over 2,000 musicians are taking part, either in the competitive Barbat Prize section or the non-competitive pop, traditional, and orchestral music sections. What has made this year's event even more special is the performance of the Iranian Police Force Music Band.
It was an honor to perform in the Fajr Music Festival, and I'm glad that military bands now also have a place in this prestigious event. I hope that more bands take part in the future.
But still, as always, the traditional and folk music sections are under the spotlight, adding glitz and glamour to the name Fajr, which means dawn in Farsi and refers to a 10-day period that led to the victory of the Islamic Revolution. This has been the reason to hold cultural events, including a theater, a film, and a music festival, going by the same name every year. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran. The German city of Munich hosts a security conference every year to discuss global security challenges. The conference this year has been held against the backdrop of the Ukraine war. Berlin, one of Kiev's biggest arms suppliers, barred Moscow from the event. Also excluded from the list of invitees was Iran. In defiance of international norms, 3 notorious anti-Iran propagandists were invited. The 3 anti-Iran figures claim that they have achieved unity, along with several others, to campaign for international support in favor of what they call Iran's protest movement. They attended a meeting on the sidelines of the Munich Security Conference on Saturday. During the meeting, Reza Pahlavi, whose family name is synonymous with decades of oppression against the Iranian nation, pleaded with Western countries to work with what he called a different Iran. He said in this case, the West would have, in his words, a true ally. How can the son of deposed Mohammad Reza Pahlavi have forgotten how Iranian people toppled his father's U.S.-backed dynasty in favor of independence and freedom? While Iranians stood up against the monarchy in Iran some 40 years ago and succeeded in overthrowing it, Reza Pahlavi has refused to distance himself from what his father stood for. He likes being named as the son of Shah or Shahzadeh, which shows he has nothing to present rather than his infamous family background. Another anti-Iran figure who attended the meeting was Masih Alinejad, variously promoted as a journalist, activist, and dissident by Western media. Cashing in on the recent riots in Iran, she claimed that Iranians want regime change. Alinejad, who has been on U.S. government payroll for years, also urged the West to take strong action against the Islamic Republic. It's no surprise that a person funded by Washington has pinned all her hopes on Western powers. Since the riots broke out in Iran following the death of a young woman called Mahsa Amini in September, Ahlinejad has been lobbying for support from Washington and its allies. She has tried to depict the Islamic Republic as an establishment on the decline, citing those weeks of unrest. The riots, however, have since died down and Iran has managed to restore calm. Now it seems that even hardline leaders in the West are not buying into her claims. The three anti-Iran campaigners have also asked the West to exert maximum pressure on Iran and made no secret of their request. They should be reminded that the country has managed to neutralize the effects of Western sanctions and plots. Meanwhile, Iran has been forging strong bonds with multiple countries and become a member of significant cooperation organizations. Excluding Iran from international summits seemed to be in line with desperate efforts by the West to counter the country's growing regional and international power and influence. The participation of millions of Iranians in the 44th anniversary of the victory of Islamic Revolution is an indicator that foreign-backed elements have failed to achieve their goals.
Another scene of wide-scale destruction in Syria, this time signed by Israel. Israeli fighter jets attacked multiple residential targets in Damascus, killing at least five people and injuring 15 others, with the majority being civilians.
All residents were sleeping in the building. This is a residential neighborhood. The missile landed here. A number of residents were killed and others injured. There are no officials or any prominent figures living here, only ordinary civilians. All apartments were heavily affected.
At 12:15 a.m., we heard loud noises. I asked my mother to step back from the windows. Suddenly, the house shook and we felt an explosion. All windows broke. We asked for help. This is a tragic reality.
The aggression caused significant damage to private property in the heavily populated Kafr Susa quarter in Damascus. Apartments, balconies, and walls collapsed, and nearby cars were affected. Syria's ancient citadel in Old Damascus was also hit. Analysts say Israel's intention for these attacks is to keep Syria in a state of instability.
For 10 years, Israel has been adopting the strategy of strategic battles between wars. The aim is to eliminate any chance of a war on Israel through weakening the enemy. Israel wants Syria to stay in a state of war and instability. This aggression in particular comes as more countries are planning to restore relations with Syria, something Israel wants to foil.
Syria's foreign ministry sent a letter to the UN saying the strikes are part of Israel's systematic aggression against civilians, urging punishment for the crimes committed by the regime. The ministry called for necessary measures to end such aggressions, as well as a clear condemnation from the United Nations Security Council. One shock after another. This is how Syrians live every day, not knowing whether they'll be waking up to an earthquake, act of aggression, or a terrorist attack. All they ask is for the international community to wake up and help ease their unprecedented plights. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The Rome-based Islamic Center Imam Mahdi has recently published a book on the late Iranian commander, Lieutenant General Qassem Soleimani. Titled A God's Fighter, the Italian-language book revolves around General Soleimani's endeavors to defend the oppressed people. A man, quote, driven by an unshakable faith in God. The book is a collection of messages, thoughts, and letters by General Soleimani, a project that has been supported by all the members of the Imam Mahdi Center.
Who did General Soleimani fight for? By publishing this book, we wanted to shed a light on a man who was always described as an anti-something. Yes, he was against Zionism, he fought against Daesh, but he did all that for God, and that's why we call him a God's fighter in our book. This project intends to fill a void in Italy, as for far too long, all accounts on General Soleimani have distorted his true image.
In 2020, 40 days after U.S. assassination of Major General Qasem Soleimani, hundreds of his posters were hung across many Italian cities. Initiatives to honor the slain Iranian military officer were held in Rome and Milan. Imam Mahdi Center's book on Soleimani also contains speeches by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, and Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani on General Soleimani's martyrdom. The publication also contains photos portraying Iran's former top military commander.
Finding good quality photos of Soleimani was a daunting task. There are only a few good shots of him around. He was not a poser. He was a humble man and he didn't love to be in the spotlight. My favorite photos are the ones depicting General Soleimani with kids and also his mother.
General Qasem Soleimani, similar to my father, because he caused that I love Islam more and more. He is my hero because he always helped the weak country or a weak Islamic country. I'm proud of him.
The book closes with 20 short stories on the life of General Soleimani, his relationship with his family, and with the late Iraqi anti-terror commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Max Civili, Rome.
I am visiting a children's hospital in Kabul, which is said to be overwhelmed with malnourished kids. Every few hours, a sick child is brought into the malnourishment ward, while doctors and nurses are racing against time to save the youngest victims of Afghanistan's crisis.
Unfortunately, this year, undernourished cases, especially severe acute malnutrition, have significantly surged compared to last year. Constant hunger and poverty and differing diseases are to blame for this, which puts us in dire need of more supplies and medical aid.
As you know, Afghans are gripped with poverty and economic problems. As a result, we are overwhelmed with a huge number of malnutrition. We are running out of beds and sometimes we are forced to reject new entries. Besides, childhood wasting as well as child mortality have also soared.
The World Health Organization says in 2023, around 17,000 Afghan babies and mothers are expected to suffer from severe acute malnutrition, while over 2.3 million children may suffer from moderate acute malnutrition. The UN body adds that an estimated 28.3 million people, which comprises two-thirds of Afghanistan's population, need urgent relief assistance.
We are a family of 10. My husband is a shoemaker. This malnourished child of mine is 3 months old. Two of my children died as a result of wasting and stunting.
Afghan people's miseries are growing day by day. Unemployment, poverty, and famine have gripped the society, with poor and middle-class households being hit hard. Many have brought their malnourished kids here, and I think it is because they have no food in their houses. We are calling on the global community not to ignore Afghans amid political and economic crises.
Concerns are on the rise among Afghans over their isolation from the international community and major cuts in global aid following the Taliban's takeover and U.S. withdrawal from their country. Afghanistan has one of the highest rates of malnutrition in the world. Afghans are calling on the global community not to leave them alone amid poverty and hunger. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Thursday, Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah warned the United States and its allies that its attempts to stir chaos in the country will not be fruitful.
I'll tell the U.S., if you create chaos in Lebanon, then you will witness chaos in the entire region. If you target our people with your conspiracies, then we will use our power and arms to make you feel pain, even if this means war against your beloved Israel.
The leader of the resistance group also said that the 2019 protests in Lebanon were merely part of a U.S. ploy, which took advantage of weaknesses in the country as part of a new strategy after the failure of direct military invasions.
Lebanon has, from the year 2019, been the target of a new U.S. plot. First, it's a plot to eradicate the achievements and the victories of the resistance and its martyrs. And second, it's a plot to take Lebanon back to being under the hegemony of the U.S., which wants to impose its conditions on the country's domestic affairs and its conditions on relations with the enemy.
Nasrallah, who addressed people during the memorial ceremony of three of Hezbollah's martyred leaders, also emphasized that supporters of the resistance group who are suffering from economic crisis will continue to support the group. Observers believe that all stalemates in Lebanon, whether the inability to elect a president or lack of economic reforms, are all the result of a wave of subtle interference by the U.S.
The U.S. is pressurizing Lebanon economically to impose its conditions and bring to power a president who is loyal to Washington and is not friendly with the resistance, so that it can implement its policies by means of soft power. Having said that, it would not seem that the U.S. has launched a war on Lebanon or the resistance. While it would seem this is an internal Lebanese affair, this is where the threat lies in their plots.
Nasrallah also touched upon the issue of offshore oil and gas exploration, saying Hezbollah will hinder Israel's production of gas from oil fields should procrastination by the companies who have contracts with Lebanon continue.
After assassination of any prominent leader of Hezbollah, the resistance would go through a landmark transformation. Now, in light of what analysts see as a massive U.S. attempt to choke Lebanon politically and economically, the resistance progress is unhindered. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. and he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty wise.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It was one of the deadliest operations of the Israeli regime forces in years. Some have called it a massacre. At least 10 Palestinians killed, more than 100 injured in a raid in Nablus. Israeli raids in the occupied West Bank have become more frequent, especially since this far-right cabinet has come to power. Is this due to the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, whose previous times in power have been marred by violence and Palestinian deaths? Or is this part of what has been called the continual, systematic ethnic cleansing of Palestinians? First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Mukhaber Abusada is a lecturer at Al-Azhar University at Gaza City. Joe Catron also joins us. He's the U.S. coordinator at Sami Doun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, who joins us from New York. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Mukhaber Abusada, I'll start with you. Taking a look at what has happened in Nablus, it has been now categorized as really a massacre in terms of the raid itself, where 10 so far have been reported to have been killed, and you have over 100 injured, and based on the Palestinian Red Crescent Society, which you're probably aware of this particular part of the report, on the number of injured, where it's over 100, and many of them have suffered more than one gunshot wound. What does that tell you about this raid, first of all? I guess first I want to get your reaction on what has happened.
According to Israeli sources, is that Israel went into the old city of Nablus to try to arrest some Palestinian activists who belong to the Nablus Brigade, who are fighting the Israeli occupation and fighting Israeli settlers. And according to Palestinian sources, that Israeli security and Israeli military men were disguised in a civilian uniform, trying to infiltrate the old city of Nablus, where they tried to arrest those Palestinian activists. And they surrounded the Palestinian home where those Palestinian activists were being. And they started bombing the house with anti-tank missiles and firing live ammunition at the Palestinians who were hiding in that old city house in Nablus. At the end of the day, as you just reported, more than 10 Palestinians were killed, including two elderly Palestinians. One is 72 and another person is 61. In addition to that, two Palestinian teenagers were also killed in this Israeli operation. More than 100 Palestinians were injured. About seven of them have been injured with serious wounds that some of them might not even make it because of the live ammunition that was used by Israeli armed forces. And as a result of that, what we have seen today in the city of Nablus is a Palestinian uprising, a Palestinian intifada, or a former Palestinian intifada against the Israeli infiltrating forces in the old city of Nablus.
Okay.
The way we can describe it, this is an appalling Israeli massacre, or a new Israeli massacre against the Palestinians. Since the beginning of this year, more than 60 Palestinians have been killed by the Israeli military occupation forces, and hundreds also have been injured. And unfortunately, this comes after a deal lately at the UN Security Council where the Palestinian withdrew a decision on which was presented by the Security Council in exchange for a de-escalation by the Israeli armed forces. But what we have seen today is that Israel has betrayed its own pledges to the UN Security Council and to
sure.
the international community to de-escalate its aggression against the Palestinian people.
Jukatron, what we need to break down here with you, because I think it's very necessary to do this, and that is the fact that we're looking at what Israel calls suspected militants, okay? When we take a look at that term as the reason for the raid to have occurred, the Israeli army has proceeded with that intention to seek out ones or Palestinians who it seems or deems to be, in their eyes, suspected militants. So let's draw out the scenario. You're an Israeli security force member. You're inside your armored vehicle, and you go into Nablus. How do you differentiate, first of all, who is against you and who's not, when presumably everybody that's out there on the street is against the Israeli forces? And this is not the first time that this has happened. So that's one side of the coin. And then the other is the term suspected militants. How do you go and you kill people who you think may have either committed a crime against Israel or settlers or what have you, or may do so in the future, when they haven't committed the crime in the first place?
Well, I think in both cases, you're talking about longstanding patterns of Israeli behavior. We know that Israel ultimately makes very little effort to distinguish. In the process of killing one target, they will think very little of killing a dozen other people along with them, because they happen to be in the same place or in the same building. This is something we've seen repeatedly in the Gaza Strip, even more than in the West Bank. Additionally, they use targeted assassinations. They simply do not hesitate to kill anyone they see as a fighter with impunity, with no trial, no legal process, no real evidence, although in many cases, we should be clear, these are actual fighters, some of them, who have taken up arms in resistance to the occupation, as they're absolutely entitled to do. The numbers I saw going around just before I jumped on this call were that two of the 10 Palestinians killed in Nablus this morning had been, in fact, resistance fighters, while the others were civilians. If we want, that's not the best used word to use. Of course, there's a sense in which they're all civilians. But we are dealing with an actual resistance, which Israel is doing everything in its power to suppress. For various complicated reasons, parts of the West Bank in Jenin and Nablus and elsewhere are simply spinning out of its control, as well as out of the control of the Palestinian Authority, which we often see reinforcing Israel's attempts to rule. And they're doing everything they're capable of to suppress this new resistance, which we haven't really seen in the West Bank on this scale since the Second Intifada 2 decades ago, And of course, they're willing to commit any atrocity to accomplish their aims.
Sure. Mohammed Abu Sada, we are looking at the death toll that happened today to equal what happened recently at the Jenin refugee camp, which was a raid that happened last month with the same intentions, with the same motives. And that was deemed at that point one of the deadliest operations since the year 2005. Now, why are we looking at these raids to turn this deadly? Maybe we can stomach the fact that Israel continues with targeting Palestinians, but, you know, the raid last month, then what happened today, and again, what pointing to a deadlier future for Palestinians. Is it because of this far-right Israeli cabinet that has come into power, headed by the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu?
That is a very good question. But let me say that Israeli massacres against the Palestinian people did not just start with the coming of this new right, extreme right-wing government led by Netanyahu, which came at the end of the year 2022. Israeli massacres have been going on against the Palestinian people for more than 75 years, starting from the Nakba in 1948, where Israel expelled more than two-thirds of the Palestinian people from their own homes, from their own villages and their own towns into the neighboring Arab countries. And over the past 75 years, more than 50 Israeli massacres have been done against the Palestinian people from, as I mentioned, from Deir Yassin in 1948 all the way until now. Now, it's also true that what happened today in the city of Nablus very much resembles what happened in the city of Jenin just a month ago, where about 10 Palestinians were also killed by the Israeli occupation forces. Israel is all the time trying to justify what they are doing, that they are going after Palestinian activists who, in legally speaking, are fighting the Israeli occupation and apartheid regime that exists on the Palestinian occupied territory. Let me also say one more thing, that the year of 2022, where it was a different Israeli government, a government by the left and center left, more than 170 Palestinians were killed in the West Bank, and around 50 Palestinians were killed in the Gaza Strip. Overall, more than 220 Palestinians were killed by the Israeli armed forces in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza in the year 22, which was more than any other year since the year of 2005. So it's not only the current Israeli government or the right-wing Israeli government led by Netanyahu who is engaging in massacres and killing and extrajudicial killing against the Palestinians. All Israeli government, left, right, center, whatever you call it, they have been committed massacres and committed aggression against the Palestinian people for many years. And unfortunately, this new massacre that happened today in Nablus just comes after a week where the UN Security Council was debating a Security Council resolution to condemn Israeli settlement expansion or condemn Israeli legalization of illegal outposts in the West Bank. What we are seeing is, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many international organizations like Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and even the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, they all have basically categorized Israel as an occupation and an apartheid regime against the Palestinian people, which commits massacres and aggression against the Palestinian people without international protection. Sure. And that's why it's the responsibility of the UN, it's the responsibility of the international community to provide protection for the Palestinian civilian population from these Israeli atrocities.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests
from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, Jokatron, I don't know if you agree. We could talk about what our guests said regarding the UN, where it didn't issue a resolution against Israel, but rather went down for a watered-down, I guess, statement condemning Israel for its planned settlement expansion. But when you talk about an organization like the UN, when it comes to Palestinians and the way that Israel has violated or not listen to all these resolutions that has been issued against it, we can see that there is no regard for the UN, and in turn, the UN has not really done much for Palestinians. So I'm going to put that conversation to the side and ask you about the most recent visit of the U.S., Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State, visiting the occupied territories to, I guess he was there to try to calm the situation down. But we're seeing, since he left, that actually the violence has increased somewhat. And then we're looking at what has happened today. So what do you make of that, the fact that that visit did not smooth things out? And in particular, when you have such far-right extremist members like Itamar Gavir, who basically has said that anybody rejecting Israel should be deemed a terrorist and in turn then executed.
Well, I think that Blinken's visit and his declared goals were unlikely to achieve much in the aftermath of a new Israeli government. Remember, Israeli political parties and governing coalitions compete with each other on the basis of their brutality against Palestinians. Each wants to accomplish at least as many atrocities as the last government, because that's how much of the Israeli public evaluates them. At the same time, we all know, regrettably, that the United States is unconditional in its support for Israel and its crimes. Our president, Joe Biden, has said multiple times that if there were no Israel, the United States would have to invent one to advance its interests in the region. So these U.S. attempts have to be seen in the context of the U.S. ultimately trying to advance its shared goals with Israel, perhaps through slightly different strategies. They might prefer that we didn't see these repeated atrocities making it onto the front pages of the newspaper quite as much. But at the end of the day, they're on the same page. They're trying to achieve the same things, particularly in the region, more so than in Palestine. They share common enemies. And the United States sees Israel as a very useful asset in the area to achieve its own goals. And that's why the United States is also ironclad in its support for Israel in the United Nations, not only blocking movement in the Security Council, as we've seen more times than I would care to count, but also using its funding of UN agencies, which is oversized, along with the funding from the other Western powers, which are favorable to Israel, and its influence on various member states to prevent any real action against Israeli atrocities.
Let's take a look at Mohammed Abbasada, the group that has been mentioned to have its birthplace in Nablus, and that is a group by the name of the Lion's Den, which is amongst a number of groups that are basically homegrown Palestinians who have formed these groups in order to obviously stand up against Israel. We know that this happened after, in March of 2022, based on what we have, where you had 19 Palestinians, you had a number of Palestinians forming this group because of the raids that happened in Nablus. And they're not affiliated to any of the common resistance groups that are out there, based at least on the records that we have. Are we looking at this being a real threat for Israel, which is why they've been targeted, for example, not only in Jenin, but in Nablus?
What we see in the Palestinian occupied territories is a new phenomena where a group of young Palestinians who have grown sick of the Israeli occupation, who have grown sick of Israeli aggression and Israeli atrocities against the Palestinian people, and also a lack of protection from the international community, as we just spoke, and also the inability of the Palestinian Authority to provide security for its own people, who is coordinating on the security level with the Israeli occupation forces. All of these reasons have pushed a number of Palestinian youth, where in the city of Nablus, where they have established the Lion's Den, or in the city of Jenin, where they have established the Jenin Brigade. And basically, these brigades, whether the Jenin Brigade or the Lion Dens, they are Palestinian youth between the age of 18 and 23 who are dedicated to fighting the Israeli occupation, who are dedicated to fighting Israeli settler violence in the Palestinian occupied West Bank. And what we have been witnessing lately is Israel continue to raid these cities, whether the city of Jenin or the city of Nablus, to try to finish or to try to put an end to this new phenomena that is growing in the Palestinian occupied territories, which also they are trying to fill the vacuum where the Palestinian resistance groups like Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and other Palestinian groups have been, to some extent, have been deterred by the Israeli attacks against them, whether in Gaza or the West Bank, to carry out attacks against Israel. So we have seen a number of Palestinian youth who are organized in the Lion's Den or the Jenin Brigade, who are fighting the Israeli occupation. And also, we have seen a new phenomenon lately in the Palestinian territories, which is described by Israel as the lone wolf operation, where individual Palestinians take things onto their own hands by going after Israeli army post or Israeli settlers to try to defend themselves and defend their villages from Israeli settler attacks. So what we, in general, what I can tell you is that as a result of the Israeli continued aggression, as a result of the Israeli atrocities against the Palestinian people, which have been going on for 75 years now, mm-hmm. the Palestinians have decided that they have to defend themselves. They have to fight back. Sure. They have to protect their own people, and they have to protect their own land from this Israeli aggression. And this is what we are basically seeing in different areas of the West Bank, whether Jenin, Nablus, and sometimes we also see the same model in the city of Hebron or the city of Beit Lahem also.
Okay. Well, since we're quickly running out of time here, Joe Catron, tell us the different dynamics that are involved here. Whether this is going to lead to something that is it should be a threat to Israel. You're looking at the one hand, what we just discussed with our other guests in Gaza City, about these groups that are homegrown, forming themselves, that don't have any real affiliation to the common resistance groups. That's on the one hand. Then you have the resistance groups that are well known, like the Islamic Jihad, like Hamas. On the other hand, you have Israel that's dealing with a domestic crisis. You have Israelis that have come out in full force for over 2 months against Netanyahu and his extremist cabinet. And then you have another factor, like Israelis migrating out of Israel, and some that's been speeded up because of the fact that they want to show in protest that they're against this cabinet. Are we looking at all these different factors contributing to be a real threat for Israel, given the fact that there's this notion out there that after 80 years, Israel will cease to exist?
I certainly think we're looking at some very real threats for Israel. The regime itself obviously sees the renewed resistance in the West Bank as a viable threat, which is why it's been responding with such ferocity. It's also contributing, in a way, I think, to Israel's internal crisis, which you mentioned, the fact that they can't seem to keep a government in office for more than a year, and there's essentially no political consensus to be found among Israelis, except in brutality against Palestinians. That's their one common denominator, and it's the reason why successive Israeli governments make it such a point to commit brutality, because they know this is the one thing that will bring different political forces together, while in the absence of a common enemy, we would probably be instead discussing an Israeli civil war.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Thank you. Joe Cotron, U.S. Coordinator, Sami Doun, Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, Mukhaber Abu Sada, lecturer at the Al-Azhar University from Gaza City. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tavoy and the team, it's goodbye.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Protests about pay and working conditions in both France and the United Kingdom have paralyzed both nations. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Reuters news agency has covered this story and tells us more. Trade Union of Junior Doctors in England said on Monday, 20th of February, that tens of thousands of doctors have voted for strike action next month, adding to a series of walkouts by nurses and ambulance workers, putting pressure on an already strained healthcare system. The British Medical Association, the BMA, which represents some 45,000 junior doctors in England, said 98% of those taking part in a ballot had voted in favour of strike action, adding that they will stage a 72-hour walkout next month. The British Medical Association, BMA, did not give a date for the strike. Junior doctors agreed in 2019 to an annual 2% pay rise as part of a four-year deal, but they say that is now inadequate in light of the much higher inflation rate today. The British Medical Association said this vote shows without a shadow of a doubt the strength of feeling among most of England's junior doctors. We are frustrated, in despair and angry, and we have voted in our thousands. The British Medical Association describes junior doctors as those who are qualified in clinical training and have up to 8 years' experience working as a hospital doctor or up to 3 years in general practice. They work under the supervision of a senior doctor. Britain's Health Minister Steve Barclay called the vote deeply disappointing. Steve Barclay said in a statement, "I've met with the British Medical Association and other medical unions to discuss what is fair and affordable, as well as wider concerns around conditions and workload. I want to continue discussing how we can make the National Health Service, the NHS, a better place to work for all." According to a recent survey, the British Medical Association says junior doctors have suffered a more than 25% real-term pay cut since 2008, leaving many demoralised and 4 in 10 wanting to leave the profession. Another trade union for doctors, the Hospital Consultants and Specialists Association, said its junior doctor members had also voted to carry out strike action in a separate ballot. That strike on 15th of March involves less than 1,000 staff. The strikes will heap more pressure on Britain's state-funded National Health Service, which is already stretched by staff shortages and record backlogs, and is now experiencing waves of disruptive strike action by healthcare workers. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's government has argued that higher pay rises would only cause more inflation and interest rates and mortgage rates to go up further. More than 10,000 ambulance drivers went on strike on Monday, 20th of February, while the nursing trade union recently announced a fresh 48-hour strike action from 1st of March. The website of Economic Times has also covered this story and tells us more. Tens of thousands of nurses and ambulance drivers across Britain launched a walkout over low pay and working conditions, marking the biggest ever strike action in the history of the National Health Service. The strike by healthcare workers took place on Monday, 20th of February, involving both nursing staff and ambulance workers, and have been striking separately on and off since late last year. The strike action was the most disruptive so far in an already strained healthcare system. Britain is facing a wave of industrial action amid the highest inflation rate and worst cost of living crisis in generations, with strikes crippling public services such as the rail network, postal service, airports and schools. In December, nurses went on strike for the first time in more than a century. Healthcare workers are demanding a pay rise that reflects the worst inflation in Britain in the past four decades, while the government says it cannot afford high increases that match the soaring inflation rate. And even if it could, such monetary increases would further fuel inflation. Britain's Transport Minister Grant Shapps has voiced concern the strikes would put lives at risk, citing a lack of cooperation between the backup services, such as the army, and those workers who are on strike. Sharon Graham, leader of the Unite Union, said on Sunday, 19th of February, she wanted Prime Minister Rishi Sunak to come to the negotiating table, charging the government with lying about ambulance workers. Sharon Graham said, "This government is putting lives at risk." Meanwhile, thousands of ambulance workers represented by the GMB and Unite trade unions launched strike action on Monday in their own pay dispute. Both unions have announced several more days of industrial action. In Wales, nurses and some ambulance workers have called off strikes planned for Monday as they review pay offers from the Welsh Government. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has already called for the bold and radical actions to end the crisis across the National Health Service. Meanwhile, a leading business company has revealed that more than 70% of UK households fear they will be severely hit by the cost of living crisis in the first 6 months of 2023, up from 54% at the end of last year. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. A group of charities have said one in four households regularly runs out of money for essentials, and voters do not believe the government is doing enough to help British families. A survey found nearly 40% of people end the month with no money left, while 24% run out of money for essentials either most months or most days. The assessment by the Together Through This Crisis initiative, whose members are Save the Children, Shelter, Turn to Us, Little Village and 38 Degrees, adds to the growing welter of indicators that persistent double-digit inflation and soaring energy bills are having a widespread impact on British households and may do so at the ballot box. The Office for National Statistics, the ONS, released figures on Monday, 20th of February, showing that more than half of renters would not be able to afford an unexpected £850 bill, prompting calls for ministers to unfreeze housing benefit, which is stuck at 2020 levels. Macmillan Cancer Support separately warned that cancer patients were resorting to selling possessions and using loan sharks to make ends meet. In findings it described as heartbreaking, the charity said a third of patients had been buying or eating less food, and 22% had been spending more time in bed to stay warm. while there had been a jump in the number of calls to its helpline about financial issues. The research by the frontline charities signals the widening political risk of the cost of living crisis. According to the survey by Together Through This Crisis, even among the 10 most affluent constituencies in the United Kingdom, 19% of people said they found themselves unable to pay for basic items such as food and energy bills by the end of most months. Matthew McGregor, the chief executive of the charity 38 Degrees, a charity that organises campaigning petitions, said, "This polling paints a bleak picture of the crisis unfolding across the country. Families running out of money to put food on the table and keep kids warm is rapidly becoming our new normal." Overall, 6% of the British people told the charity survey they could not pay for essentials most days, rising to 11% in the most deprived areas of Britain. 67% said the British government was not doing enough to address the cost of living crisis.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.